Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning wake up call. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn, on this 22nd of September 2012, as we discuss the world of sports for the next 2 hours. We have a big program set up for you on this crisp Saturday, first day of fall. No more summer's gone. Forget it. It's in the wraps. See you next year for the summer season. But we always enjoy the fall, not because of the weather getting right, but football, and some more football. And certainly we have a jam-packed edition of NFL and college football lined up on this edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. Coming up at 11:30, Roslyn Ross will join the program. We'll talk some NFL and maybe a smidge of NBA. Because that's what she does, so we'll certainly talk about that. And we'll have a new addition to the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call program. I'll save that name for you later, just what you think about that for the next hour or so. As always, 347-215-6180 is your call number. You can always follow me on Twitter at William Gerald, or hit me up at Facebook.com/SyrilQuinn, or go to my website, SyrilGeraldQuinn.com. And of course, there's no excuse not to get at me. I've given you many vehicles to contact me with any questions or comments. Blog Talk Radio audience, I am on the chat line right now. The poll question of the morning is, which college game interests you the most? Florida State, Clemson, Michigan, Notre Dame, Oregon, Arizona, Oklahoma, Kansas State. These are all very, very good games. And really, that's where we're going to begin right now, because this is really, to me, the first, and this is week four, amazingly, week four of the college football season, but this is the first big weekend of college football. And Florida State, Clemson, in terms of rankings, is the most, you know, it'll be in primetime, ABC, is the most tantalizing of the matchups. Florida State is trying desperately, and I mean desperately, to get back into the consciousness of college football as far as being the elite of the elite. They've had great recruiting classes the past 2 or 3 years. Jimbo Fisher's done a wonderful job at taking over for Bobby Bowden and rebuilding that program quickly. All he's missing now is a BCS bowl. Doesn't have to win a championship this year. Just win the ACC and get to a BCS bowl, and certainly a win against Clemson will go a long way in doing so, as the ACC is just awful. You get past these two teams, Clemson and Florida State. I mean, Virginia Tech, you know, they get picked off in the game that I did last week against Pittsburgh, and I'm like, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'm like, really, Pittsburgh? just dominating Virginia Tech, but that was the case. And the rest of the conference is terrible. I mean, Miami's in the dumps. North Carolina's not very good. We got all the controversy with them. Georgia Tech, not what it has been in the past couple of years. I mean, the conference, these two teams. And you have a Clemson team coming into Doak Campbell Stadium in Florida, in Tallahassee, that is also looking for some respect. I mean, Clemson got off to the hot start last year. Everybody's talking, are they a legit championship contender? And then they faded. Last year, they beat Florida State in a shootout 35-30 down in Clemson. Thought that the Clemson speed just too much. Taj Gibson, Sammy Watkins, who's going to play at the next level someday, was just too much for them on the outside. This year, they come into Florida State against a Florida State defense that is widely regarded by many, along with Alabama and LSU, to be the best and premier defensive team in the country. Now, Florida State, of course, lost Brandon Jenkins, their great pass rusher, who will someday, of course, play in the NFL and who, you know, had about 40 sacks in his career. So he's done for the season. But even regardless of that, Florida State is loaded defensively. It's going to hinge on, you know, can Florida State handle Clemson's playmakers? Because Florida State is going to score points on Clemson. Clemson is not a great defensive team. They are – Clemson goes as far as Taj Boyd and Sammy Watkins takes them. And they have a plethora of playmakers on that offensive end. Should be a very good game. Again, Florida State has to win this game. They have to win. You can't, you know, even if Florida State wins this game, you don't say that they're all the way back. I mean, you have to get to a BCS bowl, possibly maybe even play for a national championship to consider them all the way back. Remember, Florida State was the dominant college football program for about a decade and a half. I mean, you know, 14 straight years of top five finishes, the two national championships. The number of times that they could have won national championships is not for, you know, back, wide right, wide left, wide right, a host of close field goals that were missed against, of course, their former rival, the Miami Hurricanes. So it should be a very entertaining game. Again, a contrast in style. Florida State's great defense, which has been dominant this year, but again, Savannah State, Wake Forest, I mean, come on. I can't take those wins seriously, to be honest with you. You can't. And so this is really their first test. This is definitely their first test of the season. Maybe, and probably going to be their biggest test based on the fact of how Virginia Tech is playing. Notre Dame, Michigan, of course, also a primetime game. This game has been one of the most exciting games in college football over the past 3 years as far as drama. Each of the last four games have been decided. The last three games have been decided by 4 points. Have decided by 4 points. Denard Robinson has destroyed Notre Dame. And I mean, I don't know if there's been one player, maybe in the history of the Fighting Irish, that has destroyed Notre Dame. And that's a deep history. We're talking Notre Dame here, you know, 8, 9 national championships, Newt Rodney. But has there been one single player that has killed Notre Dame the way this guy has over the past course of the last couple of years? I mean, single-handedly, basically. So Notre Dame comes in, coming off a huge win, a win that I didn't see coming over Michigan State, and playing a gauntlet schedule. I mean, Notre Dame is going to play. They're going to still have to play Oklahoma. They still have to play Stanford. They still have to play USC. Notre Dame has probably the toughest schedule in all of college football. Already getting defeated Michigan State and looking, you know, to basically capture the Michigan State Championship, beating Michigan State, and Michigan in the same month in back-to-back weeks. Everybody's raving about this Notre Dame defense. Everybody's going crazy about it. Michigan, people forget about Michigan. Michigan is a very good team. They lost to Alabama. Alabama is the best team in the country right now, so I'm not going to kill Michigan for losing to an Alabama team on a neutral site. So Michigan, to me, still is a legit top 15, maybe even top 10 team, to be honest with you. Should be a very good game down at Notre Dame Stadium as Notre Dame, again, looks to exercise those demons against Michigan, Denard Robinson, the whole nine yards, and look to start the season 4-0 for the first time since 2002 when they were under, of course, Tyrone Willingham back in that 0-2 season. A couple other matchups you have to look forward to. Kansas State, Oklahoma should be very good, and a shootout should be in the West down in West Coast, Oregon and Arizona. Both those teams are averaging over 46 points a game. Oregon's averaging like 54, and Arizona's averaging like 46, so look for a lot of points to be put on the board in that particular contest. Looking forward to this day of college football. Again, headlined by Florida State Clemson. Can Florida State get back to where it once was, and can Notre Dame win the Michigan State Championship? So those two primetime matchups will headline the day of college football. Just getting started here on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. When we return, we'll have Saturday morning headlines. Also, we'll talk a little baseball before we get to Roslyn Ross. 347-215-6180 is your call number. This is the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll be right back. Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, as we discuss the world of sports, a busy sports weekend with the football, NFL, college football, Major League Baseball, pennant chase, and also some real golf as well. The PGA Tour is doing this this FedEx Playoff Cup that they have at the end of the season. Right now, the Tour Championship, Jim Furyk shooting a 64 is in the is atop the leaderboard, a leaderboard that includes the likes of Justin Rose, Bubba Watson, and also Bo Van Pelt. It's at the Tour Championship down in Atlanta. Tiger Woods is six shots behind at one under, 12th place. So we'll see how that turns out. Furyk is looking for his first win of the season. Only guy on the Ryder Cup team that has not won a tournament this year. Melky Cabrera is going to not be eligible for the batting title in the National League. Cabrera, of course, was suspended for 50 games for performance-enhancing, taking PEDs. He went to the Players Association, went to Major League Baseball, and basically took himself out of the running for the batting title. Did not want the scrutiny of winning a batting title and being, of course, suspended for taking PEDs, and good for him. I mean, it's a good job by him doing that. I mean, he easily could have won the batting title. He only needs like 502 plate appearances. He had like 501, but if he didn't finish the season, one would have been he could have had an extra one. He would have been eligible for the batting title. So, I mean, good for him. It's good, it's still a black eye for baseball that even despite the fact that the sport is somewhat has cleaned up a lot, that you still have guys, prominent guys coming out and being charged, being suspended because they're still using PEDs. But he did the right thing with his actions and not just making baseball look terrible by winning a batting title by taking himself out of the mix. So now something that baseball will not have to talk about if he does. Had he indeed won the batting title. Major League Baseball last night, you had Russell Martin hitting a walk-off home run against the Oakland A's, giving the Yankees a 2-1 victory. Baltimore will not go away as they doubled up Boston 4-2. Yankees remained one game ahead of the Orioles. Orioles, of course, playing the Red Sox. Red Sox have a chance to be spoilers somewhat to Baltimore, just like Baltimore was to them this time last year, and keeping them out of the playoffs. AL Central, Chicago, the White Sox drop a game to the Angels, 6-2. White Sox still, regardless of that, remain a game and a half ahead of Detroit for the AL Central. The wild card and the AL wild card is going to be interesting. Right now, you have Oakland you have Oakland and Baltimore. We're playing that one game playoff as it stands right now. You know, you get past those two teams. You know, Detroit, L.A. Detroit and L.A. are, you know, a couple of, Detroit, L.A. are a couple of games back. And I don't think that, you know, listen, I think that it's going to be, I think the question is going to be who wins the AL East and who, you know, who wins the AL East. Because I think both, I think Detroit, I think the Yankees, Baltimore, Oakland are all getting in. This is a question of where they're going to be at. So, you know, Chicago and Detroit to me are playing for one spot. Texas is a lock. The only way the Angels, I mean, the only way the Angels and the Angels get in is through the wild card. They're not going to win the division. And right now, they are a couple games out in terms of the wild card. Of course, still there's still, you know, a couple weeks to be played. Some things can happen, but it is not looking good for Detroit and the Angels. And you look at baseball as a whole. The National League is, I mean, the divisions are set. All division leaders have just commanding leads in there. I don't know, you know, the Nats 5.5, but the 5.5 games is a ton of games at this point in the season. Giants and Cincinnati have hit and ran from their divisions. And again, the Dodgers, and again, the second spot for the National League wild card is a little bit more open. Atlanta has the first spot locked down. But St. Louis, Milwaukee, the Dodgers, and Philadelphia all conceivably make the playoffs and win and get that second wild card spot. Though, you know, certainly give an edge to St. Louis in getting that spot. Milwaukee has been one of the highest teams in baseball to put themselves in the mix. But you could have a year where the Dodgers, Angels, and Detroit do not make the playoffs. And if I told you that before the start of the baseball season, most people would have looked at me like I was crazy. Especially, I mean, considering what the Detroit and the Angels did in the offseason. Look at the moves that those three teams have made. I mean, first of all, the Dodgers came into this season as favorites in that division, number one. Then they had to go out there. Now they lost Kemp for a few weeks, lost Ether. But then they made the Massa move. They get Hanley Ramirez. They get Adrian Gonzalez. They get Shane Victorino. And they're still a million games out at the end. They're not going to win the NL West, and they're probably not going to make the playoffs. Look at Detroit. You know, they go out there and get Prince Fielder. They have Verlander. Everybody, including myself, thought Detroit was going to run away with that division at the beginning of the year. And they are fighting for dear life to make the playoffs. And still only a game and a half out for the division. But again, we thought this division would be over with, and there would be somebody else, you know, the White Sox or Cleveland fighting for a wild card spot. And the Angels, look at all the talent the Angels have offensively, and even with the pitching. Can you imagine a team like that? As deep as they are with that lineup, Trumbo, Trout, Pujols, Kendrick, and with the pitching they have, with the pitching that they have, they started pitching and not making the playoffs, and the payrolls. Those are things that, you know, that they all have in common. Those three teams have three of the highest payrolls in all of baseball, along with the Yankees and Phillies. Those are probably, you know, Yankees, Phillies, Detroit, Dodgers, Angels, probably the top five payrolls, and the Red Sox. I got to toss them in there as well. Probably the top five or six payrolls in all of baseball. And three of those teams are not going to make the playoffs. And those three teams probably are not making it. I mean, it just goes to show you that you got to listen. You got to build from within. If you want to, you know, you got to draft in baseball. You got to have develop your prospects, keep your young pitching. Yeah, you can add free agents. It does not guarantee anything. If that was the case, Yankees would win 20 straight championships because their payroll has been number one for about 10, 15 straight years. And by the way, coming into next season, 2013 season, the Dodgers will overtake the Yankees as having the number one payroll in all of baseball, but with no playoff appearance this year, more than likely. keep your eye on Miguel Cabrera. Cabrera right now, flat out, best hitter in baseball. Best pure, best all-around hitter in baseball. Flirting with the Triple Crown. Right now, he holds the Triple Crown. 41 home runs, 130 RBIs, batting .333. So he's fighting. He has the RBI lead. I think he's tied with Josh Hamilton with the home runs. Or Hamilton might have 40 home runs. Hamilton has 40 or 41 home runs. And as far as batting average, he leads the league in batting average. Over, he has a high batting average. And, of course, Mike Trout. Trout is next in line at .328. He's at .330, .333, .330. So you can see, I mean, see something that we haven't seen since 1967 with Carl Yastrzemski of the Red Sox, a guy win a Triple Crown, first Triple Crown in major in the history of not the history of baseball, but first since Carl Yastrzemski. So it's been, again, a long time since that has happened. In 1967 is a lifetime ago. 20 minutes after 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. We will, when we come back, we'll talk a little bit. We'll talk some Redskins football, do a little look ahead to tomorrow's matchup against Cincinnati Bengals. Also, some other things going on in Redskin Nation. We'll talk about that and much, much more in this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call, 347-215-6180. It's your call number. We'll be right back. Try to get that to you. I hope by the end of the program. Hopefully by the end of the program, but certainly keep your eyes on it. Keep your eyes on out for that. The next NFL show. Still again, that has not been determined yet, whether it be Monday or Tuesday. And of course we'll have some fun looking back at week 3 of the season and also looking ahead at week 4. Week 4 of the NFL season, top 5 quarterbacks, and the whole bit. We had a lot of fun with last week's show. It certainly was not hail to the Redskins last week. They took it on the chin. It wasn't a blowout, but had a difficult loss against the Rams, 31-28, a game where they led at one point 21-6. And then it became the Danny Amendola show. Amendola goes 15 catches, 160 yards, and a touchdown. Sam Bradford completely picked the Redskins apart. And Redskins were playing a lot of zone early on, and it was not working out. Then you had the injuries to Character and Arakpo, who ironically got injured on the same play and are out for the season. Both of them are out for the season. So the Redskins defense right now is banged up front. Rob Jackson, Chris Wilson will try to fill the voids left by Character and Arakpo. Listen, you know, it wasn't a coincidence that after the Iraq leaves the game, the Redskins basically didn't sniff Sam Bradford as far as pass rush. How the Redskins are going to generate a pass rush, it's going to be tough. It's going to be hard because, you know, when you start sending, you know, it's one thing to, and this is what makes the Giants defense so good, and this was made the Eagles defense in the past and the first couple games this year so good, is being able to get pressure with just your front four. When you can just get pressure with your front four, you can drop your linebackers back into coverage and protect against these plethora of receivers and great pass catching tight ends that the NFL has right now. You got to come up with blitzes. You're leaving your corners and your safeties on the island, or you might even blitz your safeties. That leads to big plays. And, you know, last week the Redskins gave up a ton of big plays, especially in that second half. And they're gonna have to win some shootouts. I mean, the offense comes in averaging 34 points a game. They're, you know, top five in terms of yardage. RG3 has played great the first two games. But they're going to have to, I mean, Redskins are going to have to be, every week, the Redskins are going to have to put up anywhere from 25 to 30 points a game to win. And this week is not going to be any different because you have a young, talented offense. Now, defensively, Cincinnati has not been where I thought they were going to be so far up until this point. So I think the Redskins should be able to move the ball against them. But offensively, you know, Dalton, A.J. Green, Grisham, and keep your eye on this young receiver by the name of Andy Hawkins. He can play. He can play. He can absolutely light up your secondary. He's going to be a very good player. Only a rookie, but again, has a ton of talent, and certainly will get one-on-one coverage with the attention that will be drawn to Grisham and of course A.J. Green. Very interesting to see the defensive scheme that Haslett draws up tomorrow against that offense. That is a very good offense. Ben Jarvis Green Ellis is a tough runner, does not fumble the ball. And again, Redskins are going to have to, I think they're going to have to put 30 points, again, they're going to put anywhere from 27 to 30 points on the board. I mean, you can't lose. I mean, one thing to have depth, and listen, you watch that Thursday night game, you want to see how important drafting is? Watch that Thursday night game when you had three guys coming off the bench for the Ramsey's Barton, the running back Brown. You had two guys coming off the Giants bench who lit Carolina up. Now, Carolina's defense is awful, but still, to be able to, you know, Knicks, to lose just one of your starting receivers, your starting running back, and have two guys come out there, not only you know, adequately replace those guys, but just, you know, dominate the game. That's the kind of depth you have to have in the NFL over the course of a 16-game season. So we're going to see what Rob Jackson and Chris Wilson can do. And Rob Jackson and Chris Wilson are not, you know, they're not guys off the street. They can play a little bit. Pierre Garçon will not play out for the second straight week with a foot injury. I'm a little concerned considering the type of style a wide receiver that he is. He's a guy who depends on speed, getting down the field. A foot can be something, can be tricky. You know, hopefully he's able to get back next week, but I'd be a little nervous about being a Redskin fan about that particular injury. Also, RG3 had some comments earlier about the Rams taking cheap shots at him. I don't want to hear it. Hey, listen, when you call yourself RG3, you're going to be a target, number one. Number two, you're a quarterback. Quarterbacks get hit. And there's no secret. You know, what did Al Davis, the late Al Davis say? The quarterback must go down and you must go down hard. That's, you know, that is the name of the game in football, in particular the NFL, is to hit the quarterback and hit him as hard and often as possible. And if that means, even if that means taking cheap shots at him, then so be it. You knock the quarterback out. Your chances to win go up about 70%, if not more, depending on the team that you're playing. So I don't want to hear from RG3 complaining about cheap shots. And then, you know, I just, it just, come on. This is big boy football here. It's pro ball. It's not, you know, it's not high school. You're not outrunning everybody in college, and, you know, in college ball where you're the best athlete on the field. No, this is the NFL. Welcome to the NFL. You're going to get hit. Were some of the shots questionable? Yeah, but were they just glaring to where they, you know, they're going after your head? No. They weren't. Yeah, it wasn't. I didn't make a big deal out of it. I'm a Redskins fan after the game. I mean, the officiating was horrible, but that encompassed a number of things minus RG3. It basically had nothing to do with RG3 minus the one call where they called the flag not on him, but against the Redskins, where I thought it wasn't the flag on the late hit. That wasn't late. So, if you're RG3, you gotta pipe down. I don't want to hear about, you know, a team coming after you, cheap shots and what have you. The Rams. Listen, the Rams did some stuff, and there are a couple things if you really look back. You know, there was some jarring. There was some, they did basic cheap shots. You know, there wasn't nothing that was like malicious or blatant. This is the NFL. I mean, guys, you know, underpying piles, guys, you know, bite, kick, scratch. That is the National Football League. It's been like that for years, forever. I mean, truthfully, the NFL has cleaned some of that stuff up. I mean, some of the stuff they used to do, I'm sure when they were playing with leather helmets or with single wing face masks was like just insane. Some of the stuff they used to do. So, yeah, you're RG3, you just accept it and move on. You know, get out of bounds. And that's the one thing that's bothered me from a Redskins standpoint. As good as their offense has been playing, and they've been moving the ball, and they've been extremely productive, they are running RG3 too many times. Running him too many times. I mean, if the play breaks down, he runs for, you know, 8 to 10 yards, gets out of bounds, I have no problem with it. But, we watched in Philadelphia how that takes a toll on the quarterback. I mean, even the late Steve McNair, I mean, and he was just a phenomenal athlete, but that, you know, he was injured a lot because of the toll that his body took from all these hits. Quarterbacks, for the most part, are not built to take those kind of hits. Cam Newton might be the exception to the rule, and if he takes enough, you're gonna see him injured. You're gonna see him injured more than what you would like if you're a Carolina Panther fan. And then again, Cam Newton's a different type of, you know, 6'6", 250 pounds, built like a linebacker or like a tight end. So you would like to see less designed runs. For RG3, truthfully, unless you have a situation where, you know, he had the touchdown where the seas parted, like the Red Sea on that one play with the Rams. I don't know what formation they were in defensively, but it was, you know, you could drive a van through the hole that he had to go on. He took advantage of it, and went in for a touchdown basically untouched. So some plays like that, you have no problem with, but he's taking too many hits. And it's only week two of the NFL season. When we return on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, we'll talk with Rosalind Ross, and we'll also have some thoughts on some games around the NFL. We'll talk about that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll be right back.
On a clear which will astound you. That the glow.
Welcome back to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, 35 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour. We are now joined by Rosalind Ross of the Bleacher Report. Rosalind, good morning. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fine here. Just trying to enjoy this nice weather. It's finally the summer. It seemed like it's over. Hopefully, it's going away.
That's right.
Enjoying the 70-degree days.
Exactly. You got to love it. Nice and sunny. Pretty. Gorgeous days.
With 2 weeks through the NFL season, and obviously there's been a lot of talk about officiating, high scoring, and some of the rookie quarterbacks that have come out, five starters in all, and all of them with the exception of one, have a win right now. And that one may not, I don't know when he's going to win in terms of Brandon Weeden. Who knows when he gets his first win. But four of the five starting rookie quarterbacks have gotten their first win. What are your thoughts on the first 2 weeks of the NFL season?
Well, I think you're exactly right in that, you know, the scoring is probably one of the bigger stories outside of the ancillary stuff with the refs and certainly having lost Steve Sable. But so much high-scoring offense, and I've seen a lot of discussion over the last couple of days, you know, about really are teams moving away from the West Coast offense, that little dink and dunk option that, you know, almost sort of mimics the running game. Are teams really moving away from that? And it looks like, yes, there's a lot of deep balls being thrown, and there's a lot of no-huddle offense. You know, particularly, you know, especially if you look at a team like the Ravens, who have such a great, you know, great option at running back and Ray Rice, but still, Joe Flacco is spending most of the game going vertical to those guys, Torrey Smith and to Anquan Boldin. So I think that's what we're moving toward, but I still do think that, you know, we really have to have these teams that don't have a strong running game, even with a vertical offense, I just don't see how they're going to make it moving forward. So when I think of the cream of the crop that I've seen, of course, it's only two games. You know, I have great regard for what the Ravens can do, you know, where their season may end up, great regard for where the 49ers may end up, goodness. Basically, they just carried over all of their success, you know, last year. They've carried over into this year and really have a good chance against the Super Bowl, I think. But you really think about some of the teams like the Steelers who, you know, are always in the mix and always in the discussion, and then an up-and-coming team like the Lions. But they just, to me, they don't have the running game that allows them to be balanced enough on offense and really allows their defense to be as menacing, as effective as it needs to be for these guys to be sort of, you know, for them to rise to the top of the discussion for possible chances going deep into the playoffs and then going into the Super Bowl.
Yeah, there have been obviously a ton of points scored. Week one, I think it was a record for week one in terms of total points scored. You had five teams crack 40 points. I mean, my goodness, the Washington Redskins had 40 points. I was like, I hadn't seen that since, you know, Barack was a senator. So that had been a long time in terms of scoring a lot of points for the Skins here. You know what I think, and I just thought about this when you were talking about these teams going down the field with vertical passes. Safety play in the NFL is just not that good. I mean, that is just not. I mean, you have Ed Reed, you have somebody like Earl Thomas, who's very underrated, by the way, for those of you who don't follow Seattle. There's just not that many good safeties when you think about it.
No.
It's like Eric Weddle's great, certainly with San Diego. But be honest with you, that's not you. It's on one hand, I can't give you five great safeties in the league right now. You know, Nick Collins was one, but he's forced retirement with a neck injury. And you saw what happened to Green Bay's deep pass defense. Still, probably hasn't recovered from his injury. So, safety play has been horrible. It's just not good this year. I mean, that's just not a strong position right now in the NFL when you think about it.
I hadn't even thought about that. You're exactly right. I've thought a lot about how the Titans' safety play is suffering right now. But just across the league, I think you're right. I think across the board, we've seen sort of a disintegration of how effective safeties can be on the backside of the secondary. And, you know, I think it's hard to tell, is it that teams are really just figuring out a way to take advantage of that, or is it that guys really just don't know what to do in that position anymore? I hadn't really looked across the board to see the experience level of safeties in the league, but certainly most of the guys that are most effective are the people that have been doing it for, you know, for some time. Other than that, there's a lot of inexperience, and I don't think these folks have figured out how to defend these long passes.
Before we get to officials, and certainly you could probably do a whole entire show on the officiating, which I wouldn't, but it's been that dreadful. How about the Titans? I'm looking at the Titans right now, but I did an NFL preview show like right before the season. Me and my buddy, we both thought the Titans were going to be a surprise team, a very good team, possibly even a playoff team, and can maybe even compete with Houston in that division. They're 0-2. And Chris Johnson has 21 yards in his first two games. What is going on? What is the talk that you've heard about? What exactly is wrong with Chris Johnson? Physically, is he out of shape? What's going on with that in your mind?
I mean, honestly, I think really people are confused. I mean, some of the longtime writers that covered the Titans, and then just basically, you know, chatting with fellow fans around town and in bars watching games. I mean, we are quick to say, what the heck is Chris Johnson doing? But at the same time, you know, in our quietest moments, we can't exactly figure out what the problem is. He gets stuffed a lot in the backfield. And so that makes me think more about, you know, our concerns at the offensive line. And certainly he had some, you know, I don't want to say controversial, but they were more confusing than controversial to me. Chris Johnson had some comments this week that were pretty weird, in that he wasn't exactly blaming the offensive line, but he was not exactly taking any responsibility either. So
he was blaming the offensive line.
You know what? I think what happened is he said something and then he heard himself and he's like, oh, let me see if I can fix that. But, you know, so he tries to come back and say that we're all trying to figure this thing out together. And in that part, I think there's a lot of truth in that, because we really are confused. We can't tell. I'm not ready to say that Chris Johnson isn't the player that he was, but, you know, certainly a lot of attention on him with his $53.5 million contract that, you know, basically sat out for. And now we're like, show us the work product for that money. We're just not getting it. But we really can't define it. I want to blame him. I have to blame him, because 21 yards is just not going to cut it. I think total running yards for the Titans over the last two games has been something like 58 yards, and some of that has been Jake Locker scrambling around trying
right.
to, you know, run for his dear life. And then Chris is 21 yards. But I think the offensive line does have to take on some of the blame for this. But still, we expect for Chris to be able to find those holes and get upfield like he used to be able to do, so we can see some of that explosiveness that used to, you know, really used to make us wow at him as he gained big yardage on plays. And we haven't seen it. It's been missing, you know, for a year and a half now, and we desperately need it back. I mean, this game this week is nearly a must-win for the Titans. I mean, after this,
0-3 is definitely NFL. I mean,
yeah, 0-3 is a problem. Coming out of September, you know, 0-4, heading into the second week in October, is just not going to cut it. We got Houston. We have to go to Houston next week, and you know that's our division rival. And these guys, you know, so many people have been saying that Houston is really going to come out of the AFC South now. So if we can't stand up to them and figure out how to get a win, which is going to be very tough, because that's a balanced team. That team looks pretty balanced to me. But then after that, we go to Minnesota, and then we have the Steelers at home. I mean, so if we don't stop this train wreck now, this thing could get really out of hand. This could go, we could be 1-4, and that's, I mean, if we're 1-4 or 0-4, however that shakes out, you know, we're in a lot of trouble. And it's a hole that we probably won't be able to come back from. This matchup this week is going to be a big deal because, you know, you were just talking about safety play. We've moved Michael Griffin from free safety to strong safety. And we got some inexperience at that position. And Matt Stafford is going to take probably huge advantage of that. With Calvin Johnson, they don't have a running game, but if, you know, they're going to be trying out a new running back this week. But here's the thing, our defense against the run hasn't been good. I you know, it's just baffling me right now, all of the issues that have sort of bubbled up, because I too was hoping that we could be a surprise team, but especially given with what we did last year. But it really doesn't look good right now, and I'm wondering if
to be a situation where we have to, you know, we have to bench Jake Parker because it's tough to have an inexperienced guy in there when so many things are going wrong. You got to have one person who can make the best decision at the best time on offense to score because we haven't scored either. So, you know, lots of problems, but certainly a lot of fingers being pointed at Chris Johnson right now because you just can't have 21. You just can't have 21 rushing yards over two games. That's just not going to cut it. And I, you know, at some point I want to see him take more responsibility and really be humble and say, you know what, I owe it to this franchise, you know, to put the work in, put the effort in, and do better, and I will do better. And right now he's sort of doing this, well, you guys are blaming me, and I get that because I'm the highest paid player, so I'm willing to take the blame. What I want you to say is that you're willing to do the work so we can get better on our run offense. So we'll see how it shakes out, but it does not look good.
I mean, I just see a guy who, you know, I know he's not physically he's not, you know, we know running backs don't last too long, but this guy's, you know, 25, 26 years old, so I don't see the wear and yeah, I lost my connection for a minute. I see a guy who just looks like he's gotten fat and happy.
Exactly.
Who
kind of settled in and said, I've gotten paid and I'm done. So blame me. Yes, I got my paycheck, but somebody else has got to take. And he's got to be willing to shoulder that and take responsibility. And I agree with you. He's fat and happy, and we're not seeing any of that hunger that we saw when, you know, he was making 80 grand or whatever he made his first year. I don't know. We don't see any of that hunger anymore, and it's really disappointing.
How about you mentioned Locker. What are your thoughts on him the first couple of games? Do you see, you know, obviously he's basically a rookie. I mean, even though this is his second year, his first year starting, do you think that they're putting him in the best positions to succeed? Do you like the schemes? Do you like the plays that they're calling for him? Do you think that the offense is tailored towards his towards what he can do or what he can't do?
You know, I think the offense, and, you know, that's one of those things that has been the play calling. You know, there's all this usage. I guess I need to start calling it the Chris Johnson trickle-down effect, right? So now there's so many things that are being reevaluated in the wake of the fact that we can't get our running game going. And so, of course, one of those things has to be the offensive play calling. And so now that's being called into question because of how unproductive Chris Johnson has been. I don't have a problem with what's being asked of Jake Locker. And I really don't even have a problem of, you know, he isn't making the greatest decisions all the time about when to get rid of the ball, when to hold on to the ball. He's made some missteps there, but that's the stuff that you would expect, as you say, out of a guy who really is basically a rookie. We could handle that if something else was going right, and that's the problem. We don't have anything going right, not on offense and not out of our running game, the second component to our offense. We don't have anything going well, you know, on defense, and our O-line is making mistakes. Our secondary is bad. And so that's why I'm like, it may be, I was willing to take the opportunity to let this time develop Jake Locker because he really is our quarterback of the future for the franchise. But now I just don't know, you know, now it's one of the things where are we prepared to have this year sort of go down the drain as we figure out so many of these other problems, or do we feel better about getting some veteran leadership in at the quarterback position so that we can keep one thing consistently optimistically rolling while the other things get worked out? And that's, to me, it's hard for a young guy to be in that position. It's really hard for Jake to be in that position. But, you know, I guess the good thing for him is he isn't taking the blame because it is his second/rookie year. And we've got Chris Johnson to blame, of course, for everything that's going wrong.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, it's just it's a tough spot for him to be in. It's a tough way to learn when, you know, the other parts of your team aren't really functioning properly. So I don't know that I have a problem with what's being asked of him on offense. I do want them, you know, as the season progresses on, he will get better about his decision-making. But I don't, you know, it's a tough burden for him to carry when so much else is going awry with what the team is doing right now.
How about NFL officiating? Certainly, you know, first week, it wasn't too many things that, you know, people could complain about, you know, small things here and there. But second week, you know, the St. Louis-Washington game, the Monday night game, which everybody saw in prime time, I mean, the officials got ripped apart, and rightfully so. Just, you know, do you go into a game thinking, like, man, I hope we can make it through this game without a controversial call? Has it gotten that bad for you? How's the officiating changed your view of how you watching NFL football or how you watch the game?
It's definitely gotten that bad for me. I think what most, you know, so a couple of points. What I am most concerned about is how easily these guys seem to be influenced by players and coaches. Like, you'll see a flag thrown or a whistle blown, and it's almost as if they have in their mind what they think they want the call to be. And then you'll see, you know, a bunch of players rally around them, or you'll see a coach get in their ear, and it's almost as if they're helping them to decide what needs to be called and what penalty needs to happen. And that was that's what makes me most uncomfortable. They seem to be, you know, so easily manipulated by. And so what I'm saying here is different. You know, the NFL came out this week and said, you know, you guys are being disrespectful to the refs. You're being belligerent with them. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about the time when they're being nice and it seems as if they're trying to be helpful. And you just can't have a coach or a player having that kind of influence on the officiating of the game. That just absolutely can't happen. Too many times to this point, I've seen, you know, a flag on the ground and then a player rushes over and it gives the perception to me that sometimes the verdict has changed, like within that conversation. And I'm uncomfortable with that. But certainly the games seem to be there's a tough flow to games that you've been watching. So the games either turn out to be running really long or they go really fast. And then all these fines get handed out because the penalties weren't called at the right time. And so guys are paying for that. Players are paying for that. You know, it's basically when that happens, the NFL is almost acknowledging that something was missed in the game. So the games are either really short because so much gets missed, roughing the passer here, pass interference here, or everything is discussed all the way down to the very end of how it can be discussed. And you're looking at a game like we had on Monday night, which, you know, was the longest game ever.
That game was ridiculous. This is an awful game to watch. I mean, this is a horrible, horrible game to watch. The official made a call where he basically threw a technical flag on the coach. Like, you can't do that. There's no such thing as calling. There's no technical fouls in football. You can't throw a flag on a coach if you for you know, a coach cursing at you or yelling at you. That's not the NBA. So I guess the frustrating thing would be that they just don't know the rules. I mean, they flat out don't know the rules. I mean, they had a call in St. Louis where Fisher challenged a play that was not allowed to challenge, should have been called for a 15-yard penalty, and was after like the 1-yard line, and they didn't call it. I mean, they didn't call it at all, and you have Shanahan going nuts on the sidelines, and rightfully so. So I think that's probably the most frustrating part for a fan, also maybe even for the players, as far as they don't know the rules. They don't.
No.
They gave, you know, the extra timeout. They gave, I mean, you know, your guys were one of the, not your guys, it was Seattle, was a beneficiary of an extra timeout in week one against Arizona. That was the one glaring one they made mistake.
Exactly.
In week one, which was
exactly.
Just inexcusable. Injury, a guy gets an injury, that's an automatic injury timeout. Everybody knows that. You can be a basic football fan and know that particular rule. So,
exactly.
You know, NFL hasn't made that. That is going to be the thing that, you know, NFL is walking on some dangerous ground with that, because not only for players' safety, of course, with these late shots and stuff that they miss, but, you know, if it gets to a point where, and I don't think it will get to this point, but if it gets to a point where people start getting annoyed to where they're not watching, where ratings decline slightly, that was when the NFL will take some, you know, will I think take heed of this situation. But, you know, ratings are sky high, and, you know, Steve Young made this comment, the NFL doesn't care as long as these ratings are through the roof, and they are. Right now it's NFL 24/7, so it's not good. It's a terrible thing for the league, because it's just, you know, the game is not, this is not the game we've been familiar with watching over the course of our lifetime.
No, and, you know, whenever there is a situation where there's this contract negotiation and players or officials or however get locked out, you know, if we're sports fans, so we tend not to be fair and balanced all the time. I mean, we have a way about gravitating towards our team or rooting for whatever our particular player. You know, and these things, it's sort of hard to root. I mean, on one hand, I see these guys are being, you know, the veteran officials are being paid, you know, pretty well. But I have to respect the NFL as a business for wanting to manage costs. And I think one of the big points of contention at this point is over the pension plan, the retirement plan being switched from like a pension to an IRA. I think I read something about that yesterday. So the vets are like, you know, this is going to affect our pension. And the NFL was like, well, listen, we're putting together a package that some of you guys can make, you know, $200,000 a year officiating NFL games. So, you know, it's almost hard. You want the NFL to care about player safety for sure and about fan reaction and fan experience of the game. And then the veteran officials come out and they criticize the NFL as well. You know, and so it's hard to say, well, you guys, you care so much, get back to work. You know, and then it's hard to tell the NFL, you care so much, just give them what they want. At the end of the day, this is you know, a business transaction that is having to be negotiated, and it's getting ugly.
It's already there.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, I completely side with the officials. NFL, because from this standpoint, NBA, NHL, they don't print money. The NFL, as far as a business, as a product, is the most profitable sports venture in the world, maybe minus soccer. I mean, so I don't want it, like, the NFL to me, when it comes to money, I will never side with the NFL when it comes to, you know, when it comes to money, because they print their own money. So
yeah,
I think
$9-10 billion last year or something.
Oh, it's
revenue.
It's
I mean, it's
amount.
Crazy.
And the television contracts are through the roof. I can't side with the NFL on this. I can't blame the officials. The officials have a, you know, 401k, retirement plans, all, we know how important those are later on in life. But so I can't, the NFL just has, just give up the money. We're not talking about billions of dollars given up. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions, and maybe a little bit more than that. This is what the NFL right now is just frustrated, because I think they're going to have to, and this is even gets deeper than just, you know, officials being locked out. It's about these players who are going to sue with this class action suit led by Jim McMahon. It's about 2,000 players. So the NFL knows it's going to pay out probably hundreds of millions of dollars to those guys. So they're frustrated right now because having to give all this money. And I don't care how rich you are, you know, people become rich because they're cheap for the most part.
Exactly.
So they don't want to. That's how they became rich, by becoming a shrewd businessman and not, you know, not just wasting money and what have you. So I think the NFL is kind of in a pouty mood, so to speak, as a corporation, saying that they're going to pay this player, you're going to have to pay this, you know, these group of players, and now we got to pay these officials. So, you know, we'll get replacement officials, and our ratings will still be sky high. But it's right now, it's definitely ruining their product. One last one for you. What are your thoughts quickly on Steve Sable?
Man, we lost, you know, we lost a great visionary. Because basically, when you think about the way that fans experience the game today, and, you know, my history with the game doesn't go back as far, but so certainly the experience of NFL films has been a part of it for as long as I've been watching. But sort of all of these inside tracks and just, you know, when a player gets mic'd up and really gets the opportunity for the NFL experience to really be humanized, I mean, that all came from what NFL Films did. And certainly Ed Sable started NFL Films, and then his son, Steve, who we lost this week, carried on, and he got a chance to see his father inducted into the Hall of Fame, you know, a few weeks ago before he lost his battle to brain cancer. But just thinking about all of the inside experience, when you see, you know, the exposure we get to the game now, even thinking about the fact the decision that the NFL made to start broadcasting the combine, you know, this is probably, you know, a decision that was made from some of the way that people reacted to the experience of NFL Films, really being able to have that insight into the game experience, you know, really getting into the players' response and reaction and the experience of the game. It's really been amazing, and I hope that, you know, when you have such a visionary as part of a company like that, certainly we lost Steve Jobs recently with Apple, you know, the hope is that always you'll still get the great level of vision and forethought as the company moves forward, and that's been my sentiment this week, is that I hope as NFL moves forward that we can still feel the heart and the vision of Steve Sable and what his father started when they started the company decades ago.
Well said, Rosalind. As always, thank you for joining us, and we certainly will have you on more, of course, throughout the season. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks. Looking forward to talking to you soon.
Bye-bye. All right. See you. Bye-bye. We go from a Tennessee Titans fan to somebody who follows the Philadelphia Eagles. Jessica Daniels, a new addition to the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Jessica, the Eagles are, to me, one of the most just fascinating and intriguing teams in the NFL, because obviously all the money they spent last season, the offseason, Andy Reid trying to chase the Super Bowl. What are your thoughts on the Eagles season up to this point, you know, small portion, just two games, but what are your thoughts on the team right now?
I think they're doing okay. I mean, I still have some of the same concerns that I had before, which is, you know, Michael Vick's decision making. I think that I used to feel like people exaggerated when they said that the Eagles are going to go as Michael Vick goes, and that's usually the case for quarterbacks. But I really believe it now, because when you look at some of their turnovers and things like that, they go right back to him, either not getting rid of the ball fast enough, not running out of bounds, not throwing it away, you know, those kinds of things. So that's my biggest concern with the Eagles right now. I'm not concerned about the defense at all, really. I think they're doing a great job. I think adding D'Amico Ryan from the Texans was probably the best thing they could have ever done. Their rookies are playing out of this world. I mean, they're really exceeding expectations. But I think it just comes down to what Michael Vick is going to do and whether Andy Reid is going to continue to try to pass way too much. I mean, he called about 59 pass plays before in one game. So, you know, we don't want to see that happen too much, because I think that's just opening them up for losses.
You have a very banged-up offensive line right now with Kelsey, King Dunlap, and, of course, the all-pro Jason Peters being out for the season. Will you see the Eagles going towards more LeSean McCoy with this being the case?
I hope so. I mean, that's something that they need to do anyway, to go more to LeSean, just more to the run game, period, and also to the tight end, get some of those short passes in and things like that. So I think that they'll do a little bit more of that. You know, the offensive line was so good last year. You know, people didn't really realize, because they kind of started off rocky, but they got really good. I mean, they were the best in the league aside from the Saints. The Saints offensive line was a little bit better than them. So it's been kind of sad to see these injuries happen, especially as Jason Kelsey and Michael Vick are kind of working out who is going to call the line protections and things like that. So I think that's going to be a big concern for them. One, Michael Vick's left side, because, you know, Jason is obviously out for the season, like you said, and then also who's going to call the protection. So, you know, it is going to come down to the offensive line and the quarterback to see what they're going to do. But I don't think that you can stop Andy Reid from passing. It's just not going to happen. I mean, the pass game will still be the point of emphasis for them, no matter. The whole offensive line could die at the same time, and Andy Reid would still pass.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I grew up in that area, certainly followed the Washington Eagles closely. Andy Reid, that's the way he does. I mean, the only year I've seen, only stretch in his career where he's been mostly run versus pass is when Donovan McNabb broke his leg. And this is 2002 when he broke his leg and they had to go to, you know, either Jay Feely or it was another quarterback at that time. And they had the three-headed running backs of, you know, Deuce Staley and young Brian Westbrook and Karell Buchholz. And he had to run at that point. Yeah, he didn't have a quarterback. But, no, he's going to pass regardless of the fact that he might have the best running back in the world. So,
yeah,
you know,
I think Andy Reid just to adjust to the fact that we don't have Donovan McNabb anymore. You know, people get on Donovan a lot, but Donovan was the kind of quarterback that could pass that many times in a game. And he could take the booze. He would get right up and, you know, keep ticking. You know, Michael Vick, they're just totally different quarterbacks. And I think this is kind of like a rough adjustment for Andy Reid in many ways, and also for Marty, who's the offensive coordinator, who really subscribes to the same way that Andy Reid says. It's like Bobby Bowden said in the 70s, back when before quarterbacks used to pass all the time. He said, if you trust your quarterback, you let him throw. And I think that's the way that, you know, Andy Reid thinks and Marty thinks. So, yeah.
With that being said, you mentioned Vic's decision-making, which has been suspect really since, I would say, the second half of his first season starting with the Eagles. All right, Vic, people are up to, and you probably realize this even better than me, that Vic has not been the same quarterback since the second half of the 2010 season.
That was that's the best season I think he's ever had in his career. I mean, you know, I follow the Falcons really closely too, and his decision making was always an issue for me. I mean, and he'll admit that back when he was with the Falcons, he never really listened to the coaches. So, you know, that's always been an issue for him, and he hasn't had that drilled in enough for him to understand that, yes, you have this talent, you have this ability to run, and you have a bunch of weapons on offense, but that doesn't mean that you extend every single play. Some plays you just have to get on and get on to the next one. And that's been a problem for me throughout his entire career. That's also why he used to run so much, because he would hold the ball and then he would, you know, just take off running. If you're going to run, do it. You know, as soon as you recognize that there's a way for you to do it, go ahead and do it. Don't wait. He hasn't really changed his. I mean, he's gotten better. I shouldn't say he hasn't changed his view at the Falcons. He has gotten better with certain things, but you know, he's listening to the coaches. He's working within the scheme. His ability to anticipate the defense is a little bit better. It's not great. It's a little bit better, but and you know, obviously they went through two or three coaches while he was with the Falcons, so he was part. I think he contributed to that as well. So just got to look at how he's going to absorb new guidance. And can he really get it drilled into his head that he has to make the decisions a lot faster?
8 turnovers through 2 games for Vic. Would there be? I mean, how bad would he have to be for Reid to consider going to Foles? They drafted Foles with a high pick. Foles comes from a pass happy offense in Arizona. They're definitely high on him. Had a good preseason. I mean, again, I don't know. You know, certainly
Michael Vick would have to be horrible, terrible, and really bad for about 3 games in a row. I think it would really have to be bad because you have to understand that a lot of those guys that came to the Eagles, when you talk about that, you know, the big signing frenzy that they had, a lot of those guys came because of Michael Vick. Nnamdi came because they were in the Pro Bowl at the same time. And Michael Vick came over to him and said, you know, you need to come to us. Like, when you leave the Raiders, come play with us. And some of those guys, people were taking pay cuts. And Michael Vick is a big part of that. They want to play with him. They love him. The players just love him. So when you talk about benching Michael Vick, you're talking about, you know, poisoning
the
entire locker room. Yeah. I mean, you're you know, you're just kind of like asking for a riot. You know what I mean? And the players love Andy Reid, too. I mean, I don't think he gets enough credit for being the player's coach that he is. I mean, they love that guy. They want to play hard for him, but they love Michael Vick. And they also know, and players watch. I mean, they know what's going on with the game, too. They know when you're passing too much. If you remember last year, Jim Washburn and Marty Mornaway got into a big argument on the sidelines.
Oh, yeah.
Passing too much. You got my defense on the field the whole game. You know what I mean? So.
Right.
They know what's going on. They know that it's not just Michael Vick. And yes, Nick Foles came from a passing background, and he did an amazing job in the in the preseason. I can totally see him taking over for Michael Vick in the future. I think they did a great job drafting him. He looks like he's going to be good. However, asking a rookie to pass 59 times in a game is not a smart thing either.
How about Andy Reid? This obviously this could be his final year with the Eagles. Lori already came out and said, listen, 8-8 is not acceptable. But I just wonder, you know, Reed's been there for a long time now. He, you know, love or hate him, he's been successful, extremely successful with that franchise, put it back on the map. You know, people forget how terrible the Eagles were before he got there.
Yeah.
And he, like, I wonder if even if they were to make the playoffs and have a successful run and make it to the NFC Championship or something like that, which would be, you know, I know Super Bowl bust is crazy in any NFL city. So that's just stupid. But let's just say they have a successful season, make the playoffs, and, you know, Jeffrey Lurie would be willing to give him a new contract. Do you think that Andy Reid would just say, you know what, it's been nice. I've been here for a while. Need a break possibly from the game. You know, all the personal issues that he has had going along in the past couple of years. Can you see him walking away without necessarily being pushed out?
No. I really can't. I think that's why his agent made that power play when he said, you know, Jeff Lurie promised Andy Reid that as long as Jeff owns the team, Andy Reid has a job. And I think that was why I think Andy Reid really wants to stay. I think he'll be there like 30 years if they let him. I mean, obviously I'm not in his head, so, you know, there could be a possibility that he'll say, he needs a break or, you know, something like that. I mean, that could absolutely happen, especially with the death of his son. But I also think that he finds a lot of fatherly energy in the locker room, just the way the players look at him and stuff like that. So I don't know that I've seen him walking away from that. I think what would be more likely is if Jeff Lurie feels pressure from the fans to just go ahead and let him go. And I think, I don't know how Jeff Lurie is going to evaluate. He wasn't really clear. Obviously, he's the owner, so he can make a decision based on anything that he wants to. But I think the way that he should evaluate Andy Reid is whether or not the reasons that the Eagles lost or didn't go as far as they should have, whatever, are because of the same issues that they've had over the past 14 years, which is passing too much, game management, and clock management. I mean, those three things have killed the Eagles, killed them in the Super Bowl. I mean, Andy Reid's clock
management.
Yes, absolutely. Timeouts and all that stuff. I mean, Michael Lombardi said that Andy Reid's game management is so bad he should outsource it to India. I mean, that's how bad it is.
It's very bad. He does not.
It's very bad. So I think if a coach doesn't improve on those things, it's like Marvin Lewis throwing all those challenges and stuff like that. I mean, that's something that Andy Reid will do too. And I noticed Marvin Lewis, like towards the end of last season and this season, he hasn't been doing that. So I think you look for a coach to improve on some of those weaknesses. And over time, Andy Reid has been very stubborn about the passing issue, and he has not improved his ability to manage games and timeouts and the clock and all that stuff.
With that being said, these first two games, Eagles are 2-0, have a win on the road, a good win over Baltimore. But even regardless of that, they've still, you know, defense certainly has looked better, much better than what it was last year, second season with Juan Castillo.
Yeah.
You know, you still see some of the same things that we saw with them, where they'll physically dominate you. They'll look up, they'll outgain you in terms of yardage, but, you know, mistakes with penalties, turnovers, that they just find ways to keep you in games. I think, you know, easily they could be 0-2. Yeah, 2-0 is fine, but you say you still have a fear about that moving forward, especially this game coming up against a pretty good Arizona team that just finds ways to take advantage of things of that nature.
Yeah. But for the Arizona game, I am definitely worried about how our offense is going to perform against them because, you know, the offensive line, obviously, you know, and then also Jeremy Maclin is going to be out. So, you know,
right.
We're going to need a lot from Jason Avant, a lot from Brent Seelig. You know, Michael Vick is going to have to spread the ball. He's going to probably have to run a little bit. And I'm worried about how many hits he's going to take because of, you know, the offensive line not being able to protect him. But for the defense, because they had a lot of penalties and they were, like, just not disciplined. But I think that between Todd Bowles and D'Amico Ryans, that's going to change because I think that one of the biggest issues that they had last year was that the front and the back weren't communicating. I mean, you could almost say the front four and the linebackers weren't even communicating. the front four and the linebacker, that has been totally solved. And I even think that between with D'Amico Ryans, I think it's been solved between the linebackers and the secondary as well. So I'm not worried about that anymore. I am kind of worried about some of the penalties in the secondary because, you know, Brandon Boykin is obviously a rookie. And I think Nnamdi is still figuring out how to work in a scheme that's not just press. So that's sort of a concern. But I just think that between Todd and D'Amico and obviously Jim, I think that they'll cut down on penalties. I think the offense will be the problem if there's a huge problem. And I'm interested to see how they perform against Arizona's offense too.
This is the Saturday morning wake-up call. Cyril Quinn talking to Jessica Daniel, of course, a player perspective. You know, she also does some things with the Eagles as well. Blog Talk Radio, 15 minutes after the 12 o'clock hour, talking Eagles football here. Two games into the season, Eagles are atop the NFC East division at 2-0, just a game ahead or half game ahead of the New York Giants, who had an impressive win on Thursday. How about this game coming up with Arizona? Certainly, you know, Kevin Cobb will be starting for Jamie Skelton. Kevin Cobb, of course, was supposed to be the heir apparent to Donovan McNabb, we thought at one point. But then, you know, Michael Vick comes in, and that whole situation just, you know, Vick was just too good in that particular 2010 season, and it basically changed the direction where the Eagles were going to go. How's the talk? What's been the buzz about Cobb playing against the Eagles this week?
Kevin Cobb is a question mark. I mean, when he played for the Eagles, I didn't like him. I just didn't like him. I had no confidence in him at all. He just doesn't give me any kind of presence at all. He's just sort of like there. He had an unbelievable game last week when Skelton got hurt. So, I mean, he is capable of those kinds of games, and I think that's what kind of tricked Andy Reid into saying, okay, we're going to go with him, you know, instead of Donovan McNabb. I don't know. Kevin Cobb is just a question mark for me. And he could have a great game next week, or he could not complete any passes at all. And that's the big issue that Arizona is. I feel a little bad for them because they gave him a lot of money. They need him to come up big, but I'm just not impressed with his presence at all. I don't know what it is that he specifically brings to the game. You know, every quarterback has their attributes that they bring to the game, whether it's the leadership, the ability to call plays on their own, change them at the line of scrimmage, you know, the run, whatever. I don't know what Kevin Cobb really brings to the game. That is a fearsome four that the Eagles have. And I shouldn't even say four. I should say eight. Because they rotate them and they keep their legs fresh. That's why they get to the quarterback so quickly, because they all get rest. And I think that's going to be a big test for Kevin Cobb, because if you remember, Tommy Harris said Kevin Cobb is scared. He said if you put any kind of pressure on him, he'll just melt. He was like, you can see his eyes darting around. He gets scared. So this is an opportunity for – I think Kevin Cobb will be, number one, looking to prove himself and looking to say that, no, I'm not scared of these, you know, these strong, tough front fours. That's the first thing. But also – you know, if he can't do it, he can't do it. You just don't know. I can't predict Kevin Cobb at all. I'm glad he's not the Eagles quarterback anymore.
Yeah, I think listen, I was shocked when Arizona gave him, you know, a boatload of money. And I'm like, you know, what is this based on? It was like they had a small sampling from what he did with the Eagles. And, you know, he had a couple good statistical games to the Eagles. But, I'm thinking to myself, you could at least – had him go, you know, a whole year and see where you were at with that before you. It was almost like they thought that, you know, somebody else was going to jump in and throw him all this money, which possibly may have been the case, but
yeah.
I thought that
whoever was – I don't think they would have, because look at Seattle. I think Seattle was in the race for him as well, and they said, no, we're not giving up two picks. Now, look at the Eagles. They got the two picks from Arizona. Look at what they got. And plus they got Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie. So that was actually the best – trade situation that the Eagles have probably ever been in. I mean, it totally revamped their defense, but people weren't willing to give enough up for Cobb, and a lot of the scouting reports on Cobb weren't very good. Like, people love to say the Eagles swindled the Cardinals with Cobb, but the information was out there. But, yeah, I don't understand giving him all that, you know, guaranteed money and all that stuff. I mean, a long contract, just give him 1 year. I mean, you know, Seattle didn't go too far trying to get Matt Flynn. I think Matt Flynn is a good comparison to Kevin Cobb, because you have a few good games, but really we don't know. Now look at what happened with Matt Flynn sitting on the bench, but they starting Russell Wilson. I think think the Cardinals could have been a little more patient.
they should have been. How about this division as a whole? This is a very competitive division. Now you have four quarterbacks who all can play for the most part. Eli certainly at the top of the heap in the division and one of the best in the NFL right now. What are your thoughts on this division as a whole?
I think the division is competitive, but I think you also have the Redskins and Cowboys being somewhat of a wild card because the Cowboys' defense is just very inconsistent. I don't know what Ron Ryan is really trying to do. I can't figure it out, but I do know that he likes to blitz a lot and show a lot of different looks. It puts a lot of pressure on their secondary, and it ends up that teams can pass against them. No matter how good, you know, Tony Romo is doing, you have the other team can make big plays on their defense. So that's a big weakness for them. And also with Jason Witten, I don't know how Jason Witten is going to be able to play. I don't know how serious his spleen injury or whatever is. Obviously, he's not taking it seriously because he's forced to play no matter what. But Jason Witten is a tight end that will get, 100 targets in a season. Tony Romo has got to learn to throw to other people. Now, part of that is the receiver's fault because, and I shouldn't say their fault because a lot of them have been injured. I mean, Miles Austin has been injured. Des Bryant has been injured. But Des Bryant doesn't know a lot of routes. He looked like he was doing better. I don't know. But Tony Romo really needs it for them to create their own separation and really learn how to work the field. They're going to have to improve on that. So they're a wild card. They can have some amazing games, and then they can come out completely unprepared. I think the same thing with the Redskins, although the biggest thing for them is their offensive line has had some key injuries, and now Adam Carricker's out and Brian Arakpo's out, and that's a killer. I mean, that's really a killer for them because that defense is stout. Like, I think the Redskins defense had a great – they just had a great thing going on, so it's terrible to see it go down like this. So I don't see them, winning the division or anything like that. I mean, anything can happen. Obviously, this is football, but I don't see that happening for them because I think they still have some things to work out and some key injuries. The Giants, you just can't ever count them out. They could win the Super Bowl again this year. Who knows? Who knows? But, they have a good team.
I think on paper, Eagles probably from 1-53 probably had the best team on paper. But, again, the question marks with, Vic and –
They also have the deepest team.
Yes.
They're very deep.
Yeah. They are. So what are Eagles, what is the pulse? Give me the pulse of the Philadelphia Eagle fan right now. What do you think their reaction through two games? What are they thinking towards, how this season's gonna go? Philadelphia is such a it's a great sport. I love it as a sports now because they're so up and down. It's amazing.
I know. And I'm not from Philadelphia. I'm actually from Virginia, but I went to college in Philadelphia. So I lived, around, my fellow Sixers and Eagles fans for 4 years. So, yeah, I love Philadelphia. I think you're not a Philly fan if you're thinking positive. I think you just have to I think you have to be neutral or say they're going to mess it up some kind of way. But I do think that we have some confidence in this team. I mean, you can't deny the talent. You can't deny the depth that they have. And you can't deny even the defense's performance. Because even last year, they were 8 in total defense, even though it didn't feel like it because they gave up big plays. But really, we lost those games in the fourth quarter. It really wasn't the defense's fault, really. We lost those games fourth quarter on offense with turnovers and all that kind of crap. So I think we're looking up. I just think it's an unsure feeling, especially after last year. And, Eagles fans weren't the ones that were talking about Dream Team and Super Bowl and all that stuff last year. We knew that all those signings that they did were because they had been playing with a patchwork team for a long time. I mean, I know Donovan McNabb had to look at this team and say, hey, when I was there,
you didn't give
me anything. And then you gave me Terrell Owens. And, they went to the Super Bowl that year, but he was horrible. He was just a horrible person and treated him like dirt. And now Michael Vick gets to have, Brent Seelig and Sean Jackson. He gets all these weapons, and, Donovan McNabb kind of got stuck with, Todd Pinkston and, people like that.
Oh, yeah, Freddie Mitchell.
I know he just has to be bitter about it. I know I would be, but, we know we have a good team. I just think, you can't look up too much and then still call yourself a Philly fan.
Absolutely. I mean, I went to Temple there and grew up. Like I said, grew up around the area all my life.
You went to Temple too. Good.
Yes, I did go to Temple. did go to Temple, certainly, again, know that town very well in terms of how they think, and they're just overreaction, and just, you know.
Yeah,
hey, that's why I love
it.
You never know how they're going to react. They always take, you know, they're pessimists. I mean, they're the ultimate cynics and pessimists, but that's part of the reason why you love the home Philadelphia scene. How about, you know, what team has surprised you through the first couple of weeks of the NFL season as a whole throughout the league?
Oh, wow. I think Seattle has surprised me a little bit. I mean, not completely, because I thought they were playing pretty good last year. I mean, obviously they beat the crap out of the Eagles last year, but I'm really surprised by how good Russell Wilson is. Like, I knew he was going to be okay. I felt like he was going to be okay. I had some confidence in him. But I didn't know that he was going to be like this. I mean, against the Cowboys, Russell Wilson was 15 of 20. I mean, that is beyond efficient. I mean, he was just throwing on them. So they've surprised me a little bit. You know, Houston has surprised me by being as good as they were last year again, because that doesn't always happen. And I still think they're a top team in the league. Miami has surprised me too with their tenacity. I mean, they aren't aware of the fact that they don't really have a good team. They don't seem aware of that. They seem like they're just gonna play anyway. So that's kind of been an interesting thing.
Tell us about your website, Player Perspective, which is a very interesting website that I've checked out a couple of times. How did that come about, and what is your role in terms of that website?
PlayerPerspective.com is actually my website. It's a one-woman show. I mean, it's a little bit different from other sports blogs because it's a personal sports blog. So for me, I don't try to cover every single thing in the world. I cover what piques my interest and that kind of thing. I use a lot of humor. I try to explain a lot of things and that kind of thing. I do a lot of writing on the business of football and that kind of thing. I do some X's and O's and all that stuff. It's not really a news blog. It's really go there to see what I think about whatever is going on. And I started it back in 2010, and it's done really well. It's actually exceeded my expectations. But like I said, it's a little bit different because it's a personal sports blog. And I cover all sports, but obviously the NFL is my favorite sport. So during football season, it gets a little more intense over there in the blog.
What are your thoughts on the late Steve Sable, who passed away earlier this week?
Oh, my goodness. It's sad. It's sad to hear about, because NFL films really beautified the game. I would say NFL films and Al Davis are the two reasons that I even watch the NFL today, because Al Davis and I guess Don Coryell as well, you know, they put those air out offenses on the field. And now when we watch football, we're not just looking at a mess at the line of scrimmage. We're looking at the entire field, and it makes it more, you know, friendly towards TV and all that kind of stuff. And from there, I think NFL films just took what was going on in the field and made it into a story. Football is one of the sports, I think the main sport that is narrative driven. We love a story. There's so many players. There's so many storylines. There's so many rivalries and things like that. And I think NFL films just put that and made people feel it. And make people understand that as dirty as this game is, it's a beautiful game. It's just an amazing game, and I think that they did a great job bringing that to life.
With that being said, I read one of the recent articles that was on your website. Why do you think there's been such a growing interest? Obviously, the sport is more popular than it's been ever, you know, with television and just, you know, fantasy football and you know, just a whole bunch of things. NFL is 365, 24/7. But
yeah.
what to you has been the number one reason of the growing interest of the NFL amongst women? I've even noticed it within my own family. You know, I have a cousin who I will purposely call or text, hey, this is the game time for this particular game, and she expects that from me. She expects me to call and let you know what time is this game, because she's an Eagle fan as well from the Philadelphia area. So what I just want to know, because obviously it's been a male-dominated sport in terms of watching forever. You know, wives don't know their husbands from September to February. You know, that jokes like that. I wanted to get a female. I meant to ask Rosalind this. Forgot to. But from your perspective, why do women love football so much?
Well, I said the same thing. I'm going to say the same thing I said about fantasy football when I did an interview with HLN TV the other day, and they asked me why you think women are participating in it more. And I think it's because the marketing has become less exclusive. Because one of the main reasons that football is a man's sport is because that's the sport that you guys play and that we can't play. We can play a power club league or, you know, some flag football, but we can't actually get on the field and do an actual varsity, you know, play in college and that kind of thing. So it feels like an exclusive thing. It's sort of like the gaming community where guys, you know, play all these games and girls are now getting more into it. Once the marketing opens up and it feels less exclusive, it opens the door for other people to get into it. And if you look at the South, most girls in the South love college football. I mean, they're already following that part of it. So
right, that's a good point. Great point.
Yeah, so with SEC. The NFL, yeah, exactly. So when the NFL expands its marketing to include more people, when they have those two games on Thanksgiving or when, you know, they take advantage of those kinds of things, I think that it just opens it up for everybody to learn it. I don't think it's that women were never interested in football or it's harder for them to learn or anything like that. I think some things just feel exclusive. Now, if you go to college or there's college high school teams, that doesn't feel exclusive to a woman. That because everybody's there. NFL, I think, feels a little bit more exclusive, and so it's not anymore. The marketing has just completely opened up, and the NFL knows it, which is why they're making all these outfits and stuff like that for women.
For women, yeah.
Products. Yeah, all of that stuff. I mean, there's plenty of stuff to choose from. When I first started watching football, I mean, there were not really a lot of things for women. Like, you could get a jersey just like everybody else, but now they have pink jerseys. They have, like, girls, you know, shaped jerseys. You know, they have everything now. Marketing is a big deal. I think the NFL didn't listen to all the guys who make those kind of jokes, like you said. Like, you know, women aren't going to watch this. I think they expect everybody to watch to pay attention to their product now, and they opened up the marketing for it.
Absolutely, and let's be honest. 32 million. It was mentioned on the website. 32 million people are into fantasy football now, and women are. As well, women are part of that group. That just the fantasy football thing has grown just out of control. I mean, it's just all over the place to a point to where the NFL has stats in at stadiums, you know, appeasing fantasy football owners. So, yeah, that certainly has been a big part of that as well. Well, Jessica, thank you for coming on the program. We look forward to having you on over the course of the season, as you know, the Eagles season. Hopefully, as a Redskins fan, unravels. But I have a feeling that it's probably.
Oh, you're a Redskins fan. Okay.
Yep. I'm a Redskins fan, but I have a feeling that it won't. I think they're gonna have I frankly think they're gonna make the playoffs and have a very good season. Certainly, yeah. Be in a mix amongst the NFC contenders, But we certainly look forward to having you on in the future.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun.
No problem. Enjoy your day. Now, of course, with Jessica Daniel of the PlayerPerspective.com, gave us a lot of insight on the Eagles. Hated Kevin Cobb. And I never understood that either. I never understood why Arizona. Eagles did a great move. They recognized Michael Vick was going to be their guy. They said, you know what, we got to move Cobb, sign Vick, and went from there. And the Eagles have made some great decisions on quarterbacks in the past few years. I mean, whether it's drafting quarterbacks, knowing when to move them, knowing when to start them. The Eagles are certainly amongst the top two or three franchises in terms of just knowing quarterbacks. I mean, Green Bay certainly right there. You look at New England with Tom Brady. So they know quarterbacks and they know how to deal. They know how to train quarterbacks. They know how to deal with quarterbacks. But I never understood Arizona's fascination with Kevin Cobb. We'll get to this caller because they've been waiting for a while. Caller, what's your name? What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I actually pressed one.
Sure, go right ahead.
I was just going to say hello. If you want me to say hello, I can. But, I'm calling from the UK. So I just...
We got London. Okay. That's I've never been there, but I do watch Wimbledon. So that's my connection with London.
Okay. All right. Well... Yeah, Wimbledon, of course, is particularly famous here. But football season is here. Well, what you call soccer is what we play, and we call it football. But then you have football, which is completely different to our football.
Right.
Yeah. But I was interested to hear what you were saying about females sort of being more engaged in the whole thing of football. I think, it has changed over the years, even in the UK, that, you know, more than ever, more women are quite openly supporting teams. They go and watch from the terraces and have no problem with it. So, it's become, I think, more open as well to acknowledging and accepting women also in that kind of what is a male, very much a male's club almost. And you do get, I have friends who sit and watch football with their guys and it's no problem. But maybe years ago, they just wouldn't have you in the room. It just wasn't on. Like, what do you know about football? Why would you
right.
be here? You know, so yeah, I'm glad it's changing.
Well, also for the UK, over the last couple of years, the NFL has had those games, had games over there. So I'm certainly that's contributed to the interest of women as well over in the UK, because last year I think the Giants played Tampa, I believe last year. This year they'll have New England and somebody else. I think, forget who New England is playing over there. So I think that definitely probably has contributed to women in the UK, their interest in football is being able to watch the games out there, watch the games over there.
Yeah, and I think we keep an eye on what David Beckham's doing with Galaxy.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Even though his soccer skills are not there anymore, he's just a celebrity at this point. What was your second question?
I didn't really have a question. I was just saying well done to the show. I have been following you on Blog Talk for a while anyway. And I don't often get a chance to listen into the shows because because of the time difference. So
it's 5 hours, yeah.
Yeah, I know, but it's like when your shows are on, I'm normally doing something else because I have my own Blog Talk show as well.
Okay, great. Now, what is the name of that show?
Ebony's Real Talk, and it's on a Tuesday, 5 p.m. Eastern time. And
okay.
I'm in the UK, but it's a show about relationships. So
okay.
We get into that whole conversation.
Always a hot topic, certainly in any language or around the world.
Absolutely. So yeah, I've got that, and I do a show with a guy from Texas on a Thursday, which is called Marriage Endgame. So we do that one on a Thursday, and that goes out at 3 p.m. Eastern time. So, yeah, there's, you know, it's a difference, I suppose. But I enjoy it. But I try to keep up with other Blog Talk hosts, see what you're all doing, and, yeah, try and hop in and out of shows and say hello to people. So good to connect with you.
Well, thank you for calling the show, and certainly we will, you know, be on the lookout for your show as well. Definitely always good to hear from people anytime, from anywhere, and certainly within the Blog Talk Radio audience or Blog Talk Radio family. It's a huge family out there. It shows about everything, every topic and everything. So I hope you will certainly get back to us in the future in terms of the Saturday morning wake-up call.
Yeah, love to do that. What time is it there now?
Right now it is 12:38.
Okay, so lunchtime.
Thanks for reminding me. I'm getting hungry. Yes,
yeah.
It is lunchtime.
Lunchtime. So it's 5:38 here. So we're going towards evening time. It's been a little bit, it's slightly sunny today, but we're now getting on the cold side in the UK. So the sun shines, but it's cold.
Yeah. I've heard about that over there. I've heard about that, but. We'd certainly like to get over here someday soon, just to see the area as a whole. So hopefully one of these days I get over there and catch a tennis match or something.
Well, come and visit. Come and visit the UK. You definitely. I'm coming to visit for the first time to Miami at the beginning of October. That's going to be my first.
That's a great first visit. That's certainly going to be a great first visit. Miami's a lot. You could do a lot worse than going to Miami. That could be a lot worse.
Miami Carnival's on the 7th, so I'm going to be following that and hanging out at a friend's birthday for a few days as well. So, yeah, it should be fun. Looking forward to it.
All right, you get back to us, and certainly we'll be looking forward to your show and, as well, and certainly call us back during any time.
Will do. All right, you take care. Good show.
All right.
So I'll be here, but I'm not going to, you know, I'll be online, but I'll just listen.
All right, enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
When we return, we will have NFL picks in a week 3. Where no contract is guaranteed. And we will also give a tribute to the late Steve Sable, one of the most influential men in NFL history. We'll be right back. I have for you, four games, matter of fact. We'll start off in the desert, Arizona, Glendale, Arizona, stood up the home of the undefeated Arizona Cardinals, 2-0, a battle of 2-0 teams. Philadelphia traveling to Arizona. The line on this game is 3 points. Philly's favored by 3. And to me, this game is going to come down to the Arizona offensive defensive line, front seven, versus that battered Eagle offensive line, which, of course, as we mentioned earlier, is missing Kelsey, Jason Peters, and King Dunlap. Arizona in the past has played the Eagles tough. I've seen years where the Eagles were a playoff team, NFC Championship caliber team, and Arizona was just, you know, rumbling about and kind of going through the motions and have just beaten the Eagles. I've seen it. I watched Jake Plummer come to the Veterans Stadium, the last year Veterans Stadium, and shock the Eagles in that 2001 season. I watched the Arizona last year have back-to-back drives and steal a game from the Eagles, one of the many fourth-quarter collapses that the Eagles have had in the 2011 season. This Arizona team has had a penchant for winning close games. They'll get outgained, they'll get physically dominated, and yet they come out on top. I'm taking Arizona 23-20. I don't think the Eagles have played particularly well this season, despite the fact that they're 2-0. I think they are begging to be beat. Begging. Cleveland game was ugly. Last week's game, they were, you know, being dominated, but Baltimore decided they wanted to be like the, you know, 99 Rams and throw the ball all over the place instead of giving it to Ray Rice. So I'm taking Arizona, and plus don't discount the West Coast factor, East Coast team flying out to the West Coast. Don't discount that. That'll play a small part, not a big part, but a small part. I like Arizona 23-20. Game number two, Kansas City traveling to the Big Easy. in a battle of opposites, the 0-2 teams, two teams whose seasons are on the line. 0-3 in the NFL is like death. You're not recovering from 0-3. It's just not going to happen. The line is 9. I will take the Saints to cover, which you're saying, you're saying to me, well, why the hell would you do that? The Saints defense is awful. Yes, but Kansas City's defense has not played that much better. It hasn't played that much better, to be honest with you. Kansas City has been flat out just dreadful. I can't see the Saints losing back-to-back home games to start off the season, basically. I just don't see it. I think I love the Saints in this game. When I saw this game last Sunday, I love the Saints. Take the Saints and the points. I expect a big time performance out of the Saints offense. I say this thing has 38-21 written all over it. 38-21, 35-24, that type of deal. Like the Saints and the points, I think the Saints bounce back and get their first win of the season. Tampa Bay and Dallas. Dallas is favored by 8. Dallas is home opener of the first home opener of the season. Tampa Bay coming off that tough loss against the Giants. As much as I despise the Cowboys, I have to love them in this game and the points as well. I think the Cowboys will have a big performance. Tampa Bay's defense is awful. Giants did whatever they wanted to against Tampa Bay's defense. Just all around defense, run defense, pass defense. Tampa Bay does have some weapons that may pose a couple of problems with Dallas in terms of Vince Jackson and Mike Williams and, Freeman. But for the most part, I think Dallas will this game has 31-20 written all over it, to be honest with you. 31-20, 28-17, that type of game. I love teams in their home openers, who need a win. I love teams who are coming off a loss, coming home. And Dallas certainly coming off a loss, coming off a bad loss at that, an embarrassing loss to Seattle, will be chomping at the bit to play a Tampa Bay team whose defense is like Swiss cheese. I mean, their defense is just god-awful. So I'll take Dallas and the points in this particular matchup. Upset special of the week. You want to call it an upset? It wouldn't be a big upset at this point. Green Bay, Monday Night Football, giving 3 points to Seattle in Seattle. This is frankly just not a good matchup for Green Bay. I'm looking at a banged-up Green Bay wide receiver core, and I'm saying, Greg Jennings is doubtful. Randall Cobb is banged up. Jordy Nelson, we've shown, can be exposed if you roll covers to him. Jermichael Finley bitching and moaning about, catches, his agent, about catches and not getting the ball enough. Seattle's defense is one of the top 5 defenses in the NFL, without question. I've said it before and I'll say it again, I think they had the best secondary in football with Chancellor and Browner and Earl Thomas. I think that defense is fast. That stadium is one of the toughest places to play in the league. Marshawn Lynch had a big game against Dallas. Green Bay's run defense is awful. I think Lynch is going to have a big day. I like Seattle for the outright upset. I'll take Seattle 24-21. I just think Green Bay is walking into a hornet's nest playing at Seattle. That is a tough place to play, one of the toughest places to play in the league, even when Seattle is not that good. I think Seattle's pretty good this year. I like how Russell Wilson played against Dallas. Green Bay, again, defense to me still has some question marks. I think if you commit to it, you can run the ball against Green Bay's defense, set up some play action, even though Seattle doesn't have great receivers, but still, Sidney Rice can hurt Green Bay. Let's be honest, Sidney Rice can hurt Green Bay. So I'll take Seattle for the outright upset. I like Arizona over Philadelphia. I'll take Dallas with the points. And I'll take the Saints. I love the Saints with the points in their matchup versus 0-2 Kansas City. So there you go. 4 picks for a week 3 where no contract is guaranteed. When we return, we'll talk some Steve Sable. This is the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn. We'll be right back. Is your call number as we on this 22nd of September 2012, huge day of huge weekend of football, college football to me takes center stage today. Florida State, Clemson in a primetime, a couple of primetime matchups, Florida State, Clemson. You also have Notre Dame, Michigan in primetime at Notre Dame Stadium. Can Florida State, Notre Dame return to, you know, prominence? I don't think Notre Dame is that good. I think they're okay. I don't think they're that good. Florida State, I think, is maybe a year away from a national championship, but they have hopes on speeding up that process and possibly winning a championship this year. We'll see what happens with them against an explosive Clemson offense. Clemson has NFL pros up and down in terms of their skill position, in terms of their skill position players. I mean, Sammy Watkins is going to play at the next level without question. Todd's boy is a very good quarterback. I don't know if he's a pro quarterback, but he's very good, certainly in college. Arizona, Oregon, which will be, you know, probably 61-46, 55-50, some type. Both of those offenses are explosive. And, of course, you have Oklahoma and Kansas State going at it in Big 12 action. So a great, great day of college football. But, of course, you had earlier this week, and we've touched on it with a couple of our guests that we've had on this morning. Steve Sable passed away of brain cancer at age 69. And, you know, for me, like, I remember the first NFL game I watched, ironically, when it was Super Bowl. It was, you know, the year the Bears won the Super Bowl. It was that Super Bowl game. That was the first NFL game that I remember watching. And, you know, winter of 1986. And for somebody my age, you know, Steve Sable is like a treasure as far as a sportsman, because, you know, doing all those highlights, Super Bowl highlights of the 60s and 70s, of course, I wasn't, and even the 80s, didn't watch many of those games, but watching those highlights and, you know, watching those Steeler teams and those Packer teams with Bart Starr and Ray Nitschke, and, you know, watching Gale Sayers run, watching the, you know, the history of the NFL through those NFL films and through all the access that the NFL films provide to you is a huge part of the reason why I watch football right now. And, you know, there's nothing quite like a good story. I don't care who tells it. I don't care if you're in the barbershop. I don't care if you're just, you know, having a random conversation with somebody. A good story is a good story. And no one, as far as it comes to, when it came to the NFL, could tell a story the way Ed and Steve Sable, Ed, who's still living, by the way, Ed Sable, his father, who's 96, just got inducted into the Hall of Fame, and Steve Sable could tell a story. I mean, it's unbelievable the access on the field, the on-the-field microphone. Some of the stuff that NFL films have done is just remarkable. It is remarkable, and, you know, it continues on. And, again, you know, Steve Sable, again, my recollection of Steve Sable is during those Super Bowl highlights. Those Super Bowl highlights where you would, you know, as a Redskin fan, as a Redskin fan, that's the only thing we can hold on to. The highlights of Super Bowl 26, you know, Super Bowl 21. I don't think it was Super Bowl 21. The highlights of Super Bowls that the Redskins have won, basically, without me putting my foot in my mouth here. And, you know, Sable would come on and just give you this, you know, you would know who won the game, but Sable would come on and, you know, give you an overview of the game and how it went and tell it. Again, you know, it's just, he just was one of the treasures of the NFL, without question, one of the most influential men in NFL history. And it goes without saying. And certainly NFL has lost two of those men in the last two or three weeks with Art Modell and now Steve Sable. And again, Sable could tell a story like no other in terms of the NFL and this marriage and this great marriage the NFL has had with television. I mean, some of the footage, you know, you look at Willie Brown off the interception running, and you see his eyes, how wide his eyes was as he's running to the end zone. Or you see Franco Harris with the immaculate, you know, reception. Or you see, you know, John Riggins, who as a Redskins fan, will anybody ever forget the image of John Riggins running through that first Miami tackle and going for the touchdown that, you know, broke that game open for the Redskins' first Super Bowl win? Or the ice bowl. How about the ice bowl where it was like 15 below zero and you saw the breaths of people's blowing. Yes, you know how cold it had to be. I mean, those are images that just live forever as an NFL fan, without question. So Steve Sable passes away at the age of 69. Of course, he, again, along with his father, just took the NFL and what they did with television to a level that had never been seen before, and it continues on up until this day. There would be no, if it wasn't for NFL films, to me, there would be no NFL network as well. And, you know, I believe Oz and Ross mentioned it, doing combine coverage, things of that nature, coverage of these college football all-star games or these, you know, senior day or, you know, things of that. That stuff would not have come along if not for both Steve and Ed Sable and what they did with NFL films. A couple of other games to look forward to if you're an NFL fan. Certainly New England and Baltimore, both those teams are 1-1. Baltimore's defense certainly has played well against New England, Tom Brady in the past few meetings. They won a few defenses that have contained that explosive New England offense. And of course, New England will go in there with no Aaron Hernandez and with no Aaron Hernandez and a suspect offensive line, to say the least. So certainly keep your eye on that particular game. Atlanta and San Diego, another battle of undefeated teams. How good this game will give you a sense of how good San Diego is. I mean, first couple games they beat the Raiders. You know, they beat the Raiders in game one, and then they had their way with Tennessee, which who knows, Tennessee could be in the dumps this year. Still don't know how good the Chargers are, but we'll get a sense of how good they are facing an explosive Atlanta Falcons team down in San Diego. So those are two games to look forward to. We already talked about certainly the Redskins in Cincinnati. Chicago, St. Louis is interesting. You know, St. Louis, very good offense. Steven Jackson could be a game time decision. Chicago coming off a spanking by the hands of the Green Bay Packers. Can they recover from that? Jay Cutler with all his running his mouth. So a lot to look forward to in week number 3 of the NFL season. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. I will see you in a couple of days for the NFL show and next week for the next edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. We will return. I'll see you soon. Have a great football weekend.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.